coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The latest point in time count reveals more Delawareans experiencing homelessness, in part fueled by a lack of affordable housing.
So there's the housing shortage plus the unaffordability. Either one will count you out.
Delaware Public Media's Paul Kiefer examines why homelessness is rising in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also dig into stories making news in southern Delaware with our partners at Delaware Independent and learn about a donation of pottery fragments from the Smyrna area and what can be learned from them. Plus, Enlighten Me updates us on preservation and restoration work at Newark Union Church and Cemetery. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. An annual point-in-time count of people experiencing homelessness in Delaware earlier this year found twice as many people living in emergency shelters, transitional housing, hotels, and encampments than in January 2020. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Paul Kiefer reports on these new numbers and what could be driving them.
On an evening in late February, teams of volunteers ventured out into fields and abandoned houses to conduct a head count of people living unsheltered in Delaware. Another group tallied the number of people living in emergency shelters, motels, and transitional housing. When they combined the numbers, the teams found 2,369 people experiencing homelessness in Delaware this winter. That's more than double the count in January 2020, just before the COVID-19 pandemic took hold. And many unhoused people and outreach workers say even that alarming figure is an undercount. For some who have been homeless for years, the pandemic has created new complexities. Standing in the shadow of a church in downtown Dover, Kevin Hill says that when COVID-19 cases surged, he found himself waiting in emergency room lobbies until early in the morning, often getting discharged without ever seeing an examination room.
They didn't want you coming in the hospital because of the pandemic, COVID. They won't let you come in the emergency room, see no doctors. No place to go but on the streets in the pandemic.
But people like Hill, people who live on the street or in a woodland encampment, made up a relatively small share of the total number of unhoused people tallied in this year's headcount. The largest group, and the fastest growing, are people living in hotels and motels, paid for with vouchers provided by Delaware's Division of State Service Centers. Steve Metro, the director of the Center for Community Research and Service at the University of Delaware, says the state service centers have become a pivotal part of the state's response to homelessness.
They are now the single largest shelter provider for homeless households in Delaware. They provide more hotel and motel services than all of the shelter and transitional housing the rest of the shelter and transitional housing providers in Delaware combined.
Hotels and motels are especially vital for families experiencing homelessness, whose numbers nearly tripled during the pandemic. This year, a third of people experiencing homelessness in Delaware, at least those who were counted in February, are children, and most live in hotels and motels. Many who took part in the count attest that the sudden surge of people seeking hotel vouchers revealed something that's been lurking under the surface in Delaware for years. Susan Kent, the director of the nonprofit Better Homes of Seaford, says the pandemic brought many people already teetering on the edge of homelessness, doubled up in a family member's apartment, for instance, onto the radar of service providers.
Then when COVID happened, the resources for hotels came available to be able to quarantine. And when that happened, people didn't want Aunt Susie staying anymore because you might give me COVID and I might die, you know? So it brought forward the already existing issue of people being unstably housed.
A key driver of that previously unseen housing instability is Delaware's shortage of affordable housing, a crisis that is especially acute in Sussex County. In the years before the COVID-19 pandemic, more than half of people experiencing homelessness were in Newcastle County. This year, Newcastle County made up only 43% of the total, and more than one in three people experiencing homelessness were in Sussex County. Many of the people experiencing homelessness in Sussex County, Kent said, are simply unable to keep up with rising rents amid a shortage of affordable housing.
So there's the housing shortage plus the unaffordability. Either one will count you out. But there's both happening at the same time in Sussex because of, you know, we become this great place to go in vacation.
And for families who moved into hotels in Sussex County during the pandemic, the beginning of this year's tourism season could create a new crisis as hotels began charging their normal nightly rates for rooms.
When people started coming back, then they were like, well, if you want to pay the weekly rate, it's $300 a night. Because obviously they're not in business to do a homeless shelter. They were able to stay in business through COVID because we were able to shelter in place. But as soon as COVID restrictions were lifted, they went back to regular rates.
Because of the competition for hotel rooms in Sussex County, Metro says some families from Sussex have landed in motels further north. But he argues that even those who aren't imminently at risk of losing their hotel rooms aren't receiving the kind of support they need to find stability in the long term.
All of a sudden, they were sitting in, basically parked in these hotels and motels for like months at a time without any clear exit strategy. And housing's tight, vouchers are tight, and there's just very little case management or any other social service assistance to get families out.
The same is true for the hundreds of people living unsheltered in Delaware, a group that Kent and other service providers say was seriously undercounted this year, especially in Kent and Sussex counties. Kent and others say there's no single source behind the rising number of people living unsheltered in fields, highway bypasses, and abandoned buildings across southern Delaware. Some are poultry workers who lost their housing during the pandemic. Others have long-term behavioral and mental health challenges. Some are survivors of domestic violence. And some, like Oliver Egan, were released from prison with nowhere to go. Egan says he fared better than many. At least he knew how to make his way to Georgetown after leaving the Sussex Correctional Institution.
Georgetown SCI is out in, you know, the boonies, Sussex County. The closest Georgetown hub is not exactly far away, but if you don't know, you don't know.
And for both families in motels and people camping in forests, one of the largest hurdles to escaping homelessness is often one of the reasons they became homeless in the first place. There simply isn't enough housing to go around. Paul Kiefer, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Paul. And the Green continues in a moment with a look at some of the stories coming out of southern Delaware being reported by our partners at Delaware Independent. Stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware Public Media's partnership with Delaware Independent gives us a chance to help highlight more stories in southern Delaware. Delaware Independent is a website and email newsletter offering a combination of in-depth and hyper-local coverage of the southern part of the state. We feature some of their stories in our newscast, and here on The Green, we occasionally chat with Delaware Independent's Andrew Sharp about what they're covering to get a fuller picture of what's happening in southern Delaware. And this week, Andrew rejoins us to discuss some of their recent stories. Last time we talked, we talked about land use in Sussex County on a couple of fronts, specifically land preservation and a revision to the land use map involving the Delmar area. This week, you had a piece from Jeremy Cox on changes to the county's buffer ordinance. This has been something that's been going on for a little while. That protects wetlands and streams. The updated ordinance passed, but Jeremy's piece suggests that while it does widen the buffer, which seemed to be like what people wanted to see, it may not be as effective as one might think in strengthening protections. Can you just give us a little background on Jeremy's reporting and kind of like why this is a story?
Yeah, so environmental advocates and others had gotten together with the county and worked out some details for a buffer ordinance that would protect, you know, land along streams and stuff like that from development so that it would serve as a buffer for flooding and, you know, help filter runoff and other kinds of environmental benefits. So they seem to be saying that – the environmental advocates seem to be saying that what happened after they talked with the county was that the county watered it down and made more loopholes and stuff like that, made it weaker. So I've sat in county meetings where just person after person, including people who'd been part of the process, got up and said, please go back to the old version. Like, this is not as good as it was. They also seem to say it's better than it was before. So, you know, they're not necessarily trashing it. They're just saying this has been weakened and we would like to see it strong again.
Which I guess what really makes this a story is, like, I mean, this is kind of a great, you know, kind of look into the sausage-making piece of legislation that, you know, it starts in one place and there seems to be a pretty good consensus on, like, what needs to be done in this case. Create that buffer, deal with flooding, deal with runoff that can oftentimes include pollutants that go then into waterways. And then as it's moving along, the compromises come and it winds up being a question of, like, yeah, as you said, is in the end something, the bill, something that at least moves the needle, or is it something that just is completely ineffective? And it sounds like at least maybe there was some moving of the needle, but maybe not as much as people had hoped for initially.
And it became very complicated, so it was hard to understand. And one of the environmental advocates said, you know, it's unclear and illogical and an example of very poorly written code.
Yeah, that's usually where it, and that your point is really well taken. It's like for something like this that's very technical, that it's really easy for, as changes are made, for things to kind of just get lost in translation, right?
So one of the problems that they had with this was they felt like it relaxed restrictions on subdivisions, and not just in this ordinance but all across county code. So, and then also allowed, instead of forested buffers, to have like grassland. And so, yeah, and in some cases, instead of an 100-foot buffer, it could go down to 50 if they put it more buffer somewhere else. So they just weren't happy with those kind of things.
Yeah, there's always also the unintended consequences as well. So,
yeah.
Again, it's probably a story that will kind of be ongoing. You know, at some point, they'll be looking at exactly what the consequences are and what it does. And we appreciate the fact that you'll have people there to keep an eye on that for us. While we're talking about waterways, you also did a piece on the Woodland Ferry and the latest cutback on its hours of operations. And this feels like kind of like a deja vu story. It's like, it seems like every once in a while we hear about the Woodland Ferry, and it's about whether it's actually operating, how much is it really operating, and how much inconvenience is it causing. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on right now with the ferry?
Yeah, so historically, I talked to DelDOT, and historically they have not had staffing issues. It's been more like the ferry's down for maintenance and that kind of thing. But this time it's staffing issues. And they told me that it's a lot of what they're dealing with other businesses dealing with hiring problems right now, just really hard to get people. They are offering a little under $40,000 a year for somebody who has Coast Guard certification. So obviously the temptation for those people is to go find something a little more lucrative. But they had three captains. One of them retired, one of them moved to another job, and one of them got health issues. So the ferry was shut down for, you know, a given period of time. And they're also, even when it's open, they're cutting back on the hours. And that's really causing issues for people who use that regularly. So this time it seems to be a little different. It's often maintenance. Mm-hmm. This time it's – what they're saying is it's the same staffing crunch that's hitting everybody else.
Is there a sense of – any chance that it might get back to more normal hours, or how long is this kind of like more limited service likely to be stuck in place?
They say they're moving forward with interviewing people and trying to find people. So it sounds like, but they couldn't predict right how that would go. So
and at this point, I guess what are the biggest concerns for people who are using the ferry? Like where do the limitations, I guess, maybe have their biggest impact on people who kind of rely on this service?
Yeah, so they cut the hours back to about, I think it ends at 4 p.m. now, mm-hmm. which means people can go to work in the morning using the ferry, but if they don't get back early in the afternoon, they have to drive around through Seaford or Sharptown to get home. So, and Seaford is having its own construction right now on bridges and things, so it's left residents inconvenience, to say the least.
And probably a little bit frustrated, I would
yes.
imagine. The other thing that I thought was interesting about the story is you took some time to detail the ferry's history and its role. And were one of the two things that you found in doing that kind of research on the ferry's history that stood out to you, or maybe you didn't know?
Yeah, so it's a fascinating history going all the way back to the 1740s. They don't know exactly when it started. I did not know about the murder at the ferry. I knew that it was called Cannon's Ferry, and it had been run by the Cannon family at one point. Not apparently related to Patty Cannon, the notorious mass murderer. Apparently, she married a second cousin or something like that. But these brothers apparently were very unpopular with their neighbors. They were accused of being greedy and miserly, and foreclosing on houses and having tough loan conditions and things like that. So apparently, at one person they were having a dispute with, shot Jacob Cannon dead at the ferry one day in broad daylight. Allegedly, the neighbors saw this and approved. It's hard to prove at this distance whether that's true, but I could never find any record of that person coming to justice. There were rewards, so it seems like he kind of melted into the woods of Sussex County and was not turned in by his neighbors. So that I found really interesting. The other interesting thing was just that there's been talk of putting a bridge in there for 100 years or more, and it's just never happened. You kind of think of, they say the ferry is a long history, so you maybe think people have loved it all the way back. But there's been people who've been asking, why don't we have a bridge, for years?
Wow. It's probably a question that some people are asking now, particularly those people who are driving home at 5 o'clock and now they can't get on the ferry. They've got to drive all the way around. I also want to talk about the story we featured from Delaware Independent in our newscast last week, and that was on traffic fatalities and how the state's trying to address them. What I found interesting here is that some of the ideas the state is implementing or considering to address this issue. Can you talk a little bit about, how the state's trying to deal with this without just saying, more laws? Like, let's just pass more laws to slow people down or keep them from, putting themselves in positions to get into these fatal accidents.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, as you know, cars are inherently dangerous, and so the state is basically trying to make it as safe as possible, which is not very safe. But they really are focusing on speed and trying to change intersections are a big problem. And so, if they can turn intersections into overpasses where even if there is a collision, it'll be at slower speed and at a different angle. Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to make so that if there are collisions, they're minor, and that includes roundabouts and overpasses in a lot of cases.
And it seems like there's a lot of folks who find that useful just in general in terms of like traffic control and things like that as well. So I guess there's a long history of people wanting to get rid of like the traffic circles in New Jersey and things like that. But it seems like maybe in some ways they're making a bit of a comeback in a way to make things safer and also maybe even control traffic a little bit more. And it seems like that is a lot of what your piece was getting at.
Yeah, they definitely seem to have embraced the roundabout, and there are more coming. So
so watch out for them.
Yes.
You also wrote about the King County Sheriff's Office and how that elected official usually holds another job. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is and what are some of the concerns about that situation that may make it an issue at some point?
Yeah, so it seems to kind of be expected that the sheriff will work another job. They pay them about $34,000 a year, which is even less than a Woodland Ferry captain makes. And, it's difficult to envision, a law enforcement professional saying, I'm going to do that full time for $34,000 a year. I could not get people at the county to talk to me about the time expectations, specifically whether they think this is a full-time job or not, but it seems like the assumption has long been that they're going to work part-time or full-time somewhere else too. So and the last few sheriffs have tended to work another full-time job.
And I guess the question that winds up being raised is, like, is there any concern about conflict of interest, depending on what that job is? And when we see this, and I think your piece pointed this out, we see this with state lawmakers too, right? It's a part-time job serving as a state representative or state senator. And then they have another job. Sometimes people question possible conflicts of interest there. I guess the same type of thing might apply here, depending on what their second job is or their other full-time job is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the candidates is a full-time town manager. And so there were people saying, hey, they're supposed to stay out of politics. That's a conflict of interest. And you can imagine a number of other scenarios where, that might conflict with sheriff's duties, whether it might be a job in the housing industry where he's doing sheriff sales and also having real estate interests. I think another one of the conflicts really would come with the other employer. I mean, do they want their full-time employee being, no matter what their job is, being a sheriff part-time?
So. It's a fascinating thing. And I guess the thing that stood out to me is the fact that there seems to be nobody who wants to kind of like address this issue head on. And it probably is something that will just kind of simmer out there until there actually is some kind of obvious conflict that people say, hey, wait a second, and it becomes an issue.
Yeah.
So how about we talk a little bit more about, with summer right around the corner, mosquitoes. They're a concern, as always. Matty Loria did a piece for you on mosquito control in Delaware. And I love this piece because, you know, it's something everybody thinks about all the time when they're out. But nobody, I think, really thinks this deeply about, like, what the state tries to do. And in this case, how bad things could be if the state wasn't doing anything at all to control mosquitoes. Can you tell us a little bit about what Matty was reporting on and you know, this kind of like a different look at an issue that affects pretty much everyone.
Yeah, Maddie's got a lot of experience as an environmental reporter. She does great work. And she looked into, you know, why they do it and whether it's harmful to the environment. And, you know, that was kind of my question when I asked her to write the piece was, is all this spraying they're doing, is it having another effect? You know, as a kid growing up in Sussex County, I think mosquitoes were worse than they are now. I don't know what DENREC has done to change their approach, but, you know, I certainly, as someone who goes outside, appreciate being able to do that without being eaten alive, which until recent generations, if you lived in Delaware, that was just kind of the assumption in the summer. You're going to be eaten alive, and it came with diseases like yellow fever, malaria, West Nile virus, very bad things. And so for public health issues, in addition to just wanting people to be able to go outside without being miserable, they try to deal with this. It does sound like there are environmental trade-offs, other species that could be impacted. They try to minimize those. But as you're aware, you know, some people would say that insecticide companies are maybe downplaying the risks. Mm-hmm. So there's differences of opinion as to how bad the risks are. DENREC certainly says that they're weighing and balancing and trying to do what they think is a very safe way to do it.
Thanks to Delaware Independent's Andrew Sharp for his time on The Green this week. A reminder that Delaware Independent is an email newsletter for Southern Delaware. You can check it out and sign up at delawareindependent.com. And The Green continues in just a moment with a look at a donation of pottery fragments from the Smyrna area and what can be learned from them. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Archaeologists at the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs have received a donation of pottery fragments from a private donor. This collection of fragments came from what's known as the Green Pottery Site, a historic site at a home on Main Street in Smyrna. Paul Naska is the curator of archaeology at the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, and he recently joined Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss exploring this collection and Delaware's roots in redware pottery.
Hey, so tell me about this Green Pottery site in Smyrna.
Sure. This is Kent County's earliest ceramic manufacturing site. It dates all the way back to the 1780s. With an important local community craft production center that served the Smyrna residents as well as those beyond Smyrna. In this very early time of the late colonial period and early United States.
When did it get started?
It got started as early as the 1780s. Charles Green purchased the property in 1764, but research has indicated that the pottery probably didn't get going until about the mid-1780s. But it was in the family production all the way up until 1817.
How many items does the collection contain, do you know?
Well, we don't know the exact count, but it's several thousand fragments of the types of wares that were produced there on the site.
And this is clay, basically, right, that used to make the pottery, which turned red when it was fired in the kiln?
That's right. Think of a flower pot that we might put a plant in today, that's sort of that brick red color. It's a local clay that's used, and because of the iron that's in the clay, it turns red when it's exposed to heat. And if, just like a flower pot, though, if you put water in it, it's pervious. You could see that the water will soak into the pot itself. So therefore, it needs to be glazed, and all of these wares are glazed on the interior to make them impervious to liquids so that they could be used for a variety of functions in the food preparation and food cooking and food storage.
So when was this green pottery site found and then finally turned over to you guys at the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs?
So the archaeological investigation that this collection came from was actually done quite a while ago in the 1990s, 1991. And it was a partnership between avocational archaeologists, the homeowner at the time where the pottery site is located, and some support from our office, a staff member from our office back in the 1990s. But the collection went home with the person who dug it up. And that individual recognizes and knows the importance of this collection and reached out to me here at the Delaware Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs and was generous enough to donate that collection to the state where it will reside in state curation for perpetuity.
I was going to say, can people see this collection?
Currently, because it is not curated to current standards of professional standards. We're going to do that. We're going to wash all the pieces, number all the pieces, and begin to cross mend it. In other words, put some of these pots and bowls back together. And hopefully, we will put these out on display at one of our state historic site museums, such as at Swannendale.
Can you tell me anything about the private donor? I mean, I don't expect you to tell me their name, of course, but
sure.
I know they're an historian and scholar of early Delaware ceramics. So tell me a little bit more about the donor.
Sure. The donor is an individual who studying early ceramic production here in the state. We actually have a rich history of ceramic production here in the state. We have potters that were up north here in Kent County and then a little further south in Sussex. And he was studying these early colonial potters, particularly one up north and then the Charles Green here in Kent County in Smyrna. And so an archaeological investigation was initiated to help recover wares. All potters, when they produce wares, all of them don't survive the firing process. So there's always sort of these what we call wasters at pottery production sites. And when wasters are encountered, it gives a really good understanding of the types of wares and the styles of wares and the styles of decoration that were used on the wares that were produced at the site, and gives you a really good sort of base to understand, you know, what's really out there from this potter.
Paul, as a curator of archaeology, are there any other sites in the state that have been found, maybe have yet to be found, like this green pottery site in Smyrna?
There are certainly other sites that are known and certainly other sites that still retain archaeological integrity to them, absolutely. I can think of the William Hare Stoneware Pottery up north in Wilmington was excavated during some road construction expansion in that area. So there's certainly other sites that we have investigated archaeologically and other sites that certainly await archaeological investigation. It's best just to sort of keep them in the ground for now.
Sure. Hey, where in Smyrna do we know the exact site where the green pottery site was?
Sure. There's actually a historic marker that marks it. It's in a private residence today, and it's on Main Street in Smyrna. So if you drive down or park and walk the sidewalk, you could find the historic marker that speaks to the site of the green pottery.
I'm intrigued by archaeology. You are a curator of archaeology at the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs. Give me your background. How long have you been doing this?
Well, I started out as a field archaeologist quite a long time ago and went to school in upstate New York, got my undergraduate degree, and then continued my studies at the College of William & Mary for a graduate degree. I worked in Virginia for quite some time and went from field archaeology to a curator. I became the curator of archaeology at Alexandria Archaeology for about 5 years before accepting a position here in the state of Delaware as the state curator.
Hey, May is Archaeology Month in Delaware. Are there any other interesting things we need to know about that are going on?
We should check out the Archaeological Society of Delaware, website, the ASD. It's the advocational organization of archaeologists here in the state. And there's always a series of lectures going on at the different county chapters for Archaeology Month and throughout the year.
Anything else about the Green Pottery site in Smyrna that I'm not asking that you feel would be pertinent?
It's a tremendous resource, and it really represents our community connections in that early period of the United States when we're really just getting off the dependence on imported European goods and turning to American-made materials. So really a quintessential all-American story.
Thanks to Paul Naska, Curator of Archaeology at Delaware's Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, and R. Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And we wrap up The Green next with Enlighten Me and a trip back to the Newark Union Church and Cemetery in Brandywine 100 to check in on restoration and preservation efforts there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Last summer, you may recall, we took you to the Newark Union Church and Cemetery, where Bob and Ann Daly, a retired couple, are working to preserve and restore this little-known piece of history nestled in Brandywine 100. This week, contributor Larry Nagengast takes us back there to check in on the substantial progress that's been made. His piece is available at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me earlier this week to tell us what he learned on his latest trip to Newark Union Church and Cemetery.
So when you first visited the Dalys, when they really kind of started ramping up this project, they outlined a pretty ambitious project. Based on what you see now there and the reaction that people have to what you've seen, is it fair to say they've kind of largely delivered on this ambitious plan, perhaps even beyond their own expectations?
Well, yes, I suppose that you could say that. I mean, first of all, let me acknowledge that last year I was certainly skeptical about how much they could accomplish. And the people who have been following the project closely are saying now that they're amazed by what the Dalys have done. I mean, amazed was just a word that came up frequently in these conversations. But, you know, face it, these are two people who thought they had settled into a quiet retirement next to an empty church and a serene cemetery. And, you know, in just a matter of months after moving in, they created a new passion project for themselves.
So let's talk a little bit more specifically about this project, and we'll start with the church piece of it. What have they been able to do to the exterior of the church?
Well, okay, no need to get into too much detail here. Probably the best thing to do is read off a list. Here you go. They've been removing, restoring, and reinstalling 7 massive Lancet windows and 2 smaller ones. Also, installing a new cedar shake roof, repairing and repainting the stucco exterior, putting a stone frame around the 1845 date stone that's near the peak of the roof, repointing the chimney, adding drainage gutters, which is a first for the church, repairing the soffits, repairing a transom window, and replacing the clapboard in the foyer. Now, that's what's been done. Soon to come, outdoors, what's going on inside is a storage shed, a carriage house, and a restroom, complete with a compost toilet.
And that's just the exterior. Let's head inside. What is the plan inside? What are they doing on the interior of the church?
Okay, well, first of all, ceiling tiles, which are part of a renovation made at some point in the 20th century, have been removed. And that's opened up a view through the beams up to the 1845 rafters at the top of the church, which are now being cleaned. Mold and mildew have been removed. Old paint has been scraped off the walls. The plaster has been repaired. Wainscoting is being installed. Also on the way is something that wasn't available either when the church was built or when it was restored in 1906, air conditioning. Work on restoring the pews is going to begin next month in June, according to Bob Daly. And now only 4 of those pews are now in the church. The other 17 are being stored temporarily in a neighbor's garage.
And I will say, that's a lot of stuff you've just read off there. If people want to get at least a taste of what he's talking about, go to the story at DelawarePublic.org. There's a number of pictures there to give you at least a sense of what all that looks like in reality. Now, ultimately, Larry, what is the plan for the church, and where do things stand with those efforts to give the church a new purpose?
Well, the plan here is to create what's really going to be a multi-purpose facility. It's envisioned to be a venue for weddings. It's also a place for civic groups and community organizations to meet, and a museum. And all of these activities are, you know, certainly feasible and interrelated.
Can you tell us a little bit about the museum piece, because that interests me a lot. And yeah, I guess a lot of people are kind of wondering, it's a multi-purpose facility that they're gunning for, that doesn't necessarily jibe with the idea of a museum. What is it going to look like? What will this museum highlight? And how's it going to work when it's also serving these other purposes?
Yeah, again, it seems like this might be an example of something of the New York Union Corporation biting off more than it can chew. But that also means it's going to be an opportunity to surprise me and many others when it does actually work out. The museum itself would have 3 themes, and that sounds kind of tough, but here you go. First, it would include artifacts from the wars in which veterans buried in the church's cemetery had fought, and that covers everything from the American Revolution up through Vietnam. Next, it would describe life in Brandywine Hundred from the mid-1800s, when the church was built, through 1906, when it was renovated. And finally, it would tell the story of the prominent families of Brandywine Hundred, whose members are buried in the cemetery, the Weldons, the Sharpleys, the Husbands, the Forwoods, the Beesons, and so many other names that people in the area north of Wilmington are quite familiar with. Now, this multi-purpose use does create a bit of a challenge, and that's why they're building that storage shed that I mentioned outside. For weddings, they would expect to use those church pews, which would be stored in the shed that they're getting until they're needed for a wedding ceremony. Now, the museum displays themselves would be movable so that they could be rolled either to the sides of the church or carried into the shed to make room for the wedding guests. And then for community meetings, they could probably keep these museum exhibits rolled over towards the side and use folding chairs in the museum area for meeting purposes. So they've got ideas on how to make this work, and now just a case of finishing up the restoration and going on to the next phase of creating the museum and furnishing it out.
So we've talked about what's going on inside and outside the church. Let's move over to the cemetery now. What's being done there, and what are some of the challenges of getting that piece of this project up to where they want it to be?
Well, you know, last year they completed one significant project, which was completing a memorial to veterans and installing an illuminated flagpole. A second significant project, a memorial garden with benches and plantings, is now nearing completion. What's left is something that did start a year ago and quite literally calls for some heavy lifting. And that's the raising of dozens of headstones that had sunk into the ground, often more than a foot or two down. Bob Daly and other volunteers are using digging poles to lift the smaller stones, but the larger ones, and some of them I'm told weigh 1,600 pounds or more, need the work of a professional who uses hoists and cranes to lift these large pieces from below the surface. Now, most of this work is being paid for by a grant from the state's Distressed Cemetery Fund. Anyhow, once the stones are lifted, they do have to be cleaned. And very often when the stones are cleaned, they find inscriptions that had been hidden from view for 100 years or more because the stones had been submerged. Then, of course, the holes there from where the stones had fallen have to be filled in. Fresh concrete has to be poured. And then the gravestones are returned to their original position, leveled, and put back into place.
And as you've mentioned a little bit in our conversation already, a lot of what's important about this cemetery is who's there, including various veterans from wars dating all the way back to the Revolutionary War. What's being done to commemorate that part of the cemetery, those people who are buried there?
Well, it's not so much that part of the cemetery as because the veterans' graves are really throughout the site, because the veterans are parts of so many of these different families. But Bob Daly does tell me that when he goes out to lift up the sunken headstones where their locations have been identified, he often finds evidence of even more stones that have to be lifted up and recovered. And it's the same way with the veterans' graves. Originally, they thought that they had 38 veterans buried at Newark Union among the more than 900 people who are interred there. Now the number is up to 75, and that means that at each one of those veterans' graves, they install a flag and a medallion at each one of those grave sites. And of course, these numbers of veterans buried there is likely to grow because the Dalys are continuously doing research to try to find out more about each of the individuals who's buried there. And then on top of that, the relatives of the deceased come to the cemetery and often share the stories of their loved ones with the Dalys.
Of course, all of this costs money to do. So how do we pay for this part of this work going? Are there plans to raise some more money to make sure they can kind of keep doing this?
Well, this is one of those projects that, when potential donors come out and see it and look at what's going on, it earns grants on its merits. So they've gotten a large five-figure grant from the Crystal Trust, which is a fairly prominent but low-key philanthropic organization in Wilmington with some DuPont family connections. They've gotten significant grants from the Welfare Foundation and Preservation Delaware, some help from Newcastle County, and as I mentioned, the state's Distressed Cemetery Fund. An individual donor kicked in $15,000 last year to help with those window restorations. Total costs for both of these projects, the church and the cemetery, is probably going to wind up somewhere north of $200,000. And I strongly suspect that Newark Union is going to find a way to raise it all. Now, they're just about to start a couple of small donor campaigns to preserve the church pews and to put bricks in the memorial garden. They're asking the state for some community reinvestment funds. And the Dalys, as you might have gathered, have become pretty good about figuring out how to ask for money from foundations.
Well, you mentioned the Dalys, and we've mentioned before that this couple is driving this whole process, but they are retired, and they can only lead it for so long. So is there any sense that there's others who are ready to step in and take up this work so that it will sustain itself long term?
Well, I'm going to say no in terms of others right now. But, the fact is, the Dalys are in their 60s. They're still in their 60s. Hey, they're younger than I am, and they've got plenty of vigor and enthusiasm. But you're right. There is a difference between having a passion project and sinking into a bottomless pit. Now, my sense here is that the church and the cemetery work should be done in about 2 years. And when that happens, Newark Union is probably going to want to hire a part-time manager to oversee see the museum and to schedule the events. You know, and when that comes, I think the dailies will be ready to step aside. And until then, I think they're going to be working as hard as they can to create this magnificent piece of living history in the heart of Brandywine 100.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for enlightening us this week. His piece on progress to restore and preserve Newark Union Church and Cemetery is available at DelawarePublic.org. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, the NPR One app, and the new Delaware Public Media app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nightingale, Delaware Independent's Andrew Sharp, and Delaware Public Media's Paul Kiefer and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Fern saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.